Welcome to Logicgate episode number 5, where we're discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. I'm your host, Scott, and as always, I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Hello.
And Jason.
Hey, aka Nuge.
Way to that, fill the audience in.
Well handled. Well handled.
There. Cleared up.
So before we get started, I think we do need to have some follow-up from the last episode, because I actually took some notes. I did a little bit of research. I want to talk a little bit about... So in the last episode, I asked the question about whether we knew from the original trilogy that Mon Mothma was a senator or not. And after doing some research on that, Mon Mothma is not only never mentioned that she's a senator, but she's never even given a name in the original trilogy. It's never said on screen, I should say. She may have a credit, or it may have been in the extended universe, but as far as the normal audience goes, she's just the leader of an unnamed leader of the rebellion.
Wasn't she in Rebels?
There's so much Dark Wars out there that I haven't seen all of it, but from my point of view, from the original trilogy, she was not named, and she was definitely not a senator back then.
Fair enough.
Another note I had was that when they get to Luthen's fake store where he's selling those, you know, coins or whatever to Mon Mothma's driver, there was an interesting homage to, there's an armor that's in the back, there's a backdrop of one of those, and it's the armor from the Force Unleashed video game. So, like, they had some screenshots I saw online of the screenshot from the episode and the armor from the video game. So they actually brought that to life, which was kind of cool. And if you look really close, it's kind of hard to tell, but there may be some Mandalorian armor in that as well. It's kind of laying down, so it's harder to see. But so there's definitely some nods to the larger Star Wars universe in his shop. And there's actually a couple more Easter eggs in this episode as well.
Yeah, this show has had some, like, deep cuts, like, some really interesting references. Like, this is the real, like, fan service that I think is appropriate.
Right.
And is awesome. There's one later that we'll get to.
Yeah.
I found out about just because, yeah, I've watched some, like, Easter egg videos and stuff.
So, the other question that I had, I was going to ask you guys, and I was going to see if you know. So, if you look up, I mean, if you just Google search Andor, and you look at the logo for the show, it has sort of that weird looking symbol for the O. I think we talked about this like on the first episode.
Right.
Do you guys know what that symbol is for the O?
I do not.
I do not.
The original, in the original like advertisements for it. Is that not like a Rebel?
Well, yeah.
No, it's not the Rebel logo. It's that's where I was going with this. I think I asked on the original podcast, I asked about... Because they have the logos two ways. They have like the stylized O where the O is inverted from the other letters, but they also have Andor spelled out, and the O sort of looks like a rebellion symbol, but it's not the rebel. That's not the typical rebel symbol we know from the original series. So I couldn't figure out where that logo comes from. Honestly, it looks like the Quake logo to me. It was just because I play a lot of Quake. But I did some digging, and that logo is actually... it's one of the early passes of the Rebellion logo. So this is like Rebellion logo, like version 1.0. So the Rebellion doesn't really exist in the Andor universe quite yet, but it is starting to form, and they come up with, I assume this comes up in the show, that they probably come up with this as a first pass at a logo, and then it evolves into the Rebellion logo that we know and love later. But so that's sort of a nod to the burgeoning Rebel Alliance.
Kind of like the Civil War, like the early Rebel flags were quite different.
Oh, sure, yeah. And the one last note, and then we'll get started for real, was there was an interview Tony Gilroy did. He was on the WTF podcast with Mark Maron, and he mentioned, I think we talked about it briefly, that the outline for this show is going to be 2 12-episode seasons. And the first 12 episodes, so the ones that we're watching right now, are going to take place over the course of 1 year. And according to Tony Gilroy, you're going to take Cassian from a nobody, kind of a loser, into a true revolutionary. So the first 12 episodes are going to be over the course of a year. And then the second 12 episodes are going to be spread out over 4 years of Cassian's life. And I'm sure they're going to get us closer to Rogue One. So it's already been determined that it's just going to be 2 12-episode seasons, and they do have a time period for those two. So
I wanted to talk about that podcast a little bit because we both listened to it, and I got to actually talk about it.
Now's the time. Yeah, go for it.
Well, I just thought the Gilroys have a pretty fascinating story. Like, they seem kind of really down-to-earth dudes, even though, like, they're all in show business and their dad was in show business, but, like...
And they're all successful.
Yeah, they're all doing really well. But apparently, the dad was, like, a druggie, like almost, you know... Tony says, like, if it wasn't for the draft, he'd probably be dead. So he went into the army.
Yeah. And he had a major gambling problem, too. Yeah.
Gambling. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it was pretty interesting. He kind of had the whole gamut of a life story.
Right.
And they just seem like pretty cool, down-to-earth, you know, guys. That kind of workmen writers. They don't seem like they're really flashy. They don't seem like they're auteurs necessarily. They just seem like they're, you know, hard workers.
So it's worth mentioning, because you just mentioned it, and he talks about it in that interview, that so there are three Gilroy brothers, right? There's Tony, who's the main driving force behind Andor.
And then we're not ranking here, right?
And then there's Dan, who's directing the episodes that we're, and writing the episodes that we're watching right now. And then who's the third one? I think it was Ben.
John,
and he does a lot of editing behind this. He's more behind the scenes, but legitimately, all three of them are actually working on this show. So that's kind of cool. So they got three brothers all working together.
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah.
Is there anything else?
I highly recommend people listen to the interview. There's like a little snippet about the Devil's Advocate and how they filmed it in Trump's garish apartment, and he goes in on that whole situation.
Yeah, so if you're interested, it's the WTF podcast with Mark Maron. I don't remember what episode number it was, like 1300 something. Yeah, it's definitely interesting if you're an Andor fan and or a Tony Gilroy fan, worth listening to. Any other corrections or follow-up from last time before we dive into the episode?
Not so much a follow-up, but I do just kind of like I sort of warned you, for lack of a better term, the last episode that I was going to be complaining about the writing. I will offer the same advanced notice. Not a complaint, actually, quite the opposite. Overall theme, I felt that the writing was a bit more picked up. But additionally, I kind of had a moment where I realized I was so focused on the writing that I was sort of overlooking other aspects of the show, the sound design, the set design, you know, all of the other pieces that go into it. So I tried to look a little bit more towards that stuff.
Okay.
This episode.
Fair enough.
What do you guys think about how they're releasing the episodes? Like, there's an article I came across called Star Wars Andor release schedule was a mistake from denofgeek.com. And basically they say, like, these episodes are so tied together. They really feel like they should be releasing these in the three episode chunks like they did the first three. What do you think about that?
I could see that. So... yeah, interesting, because they did release the first three as a group. You're saying they should have released them all in groups of three so that they come out as a cohesive storyline?
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn. I mean, I would really like to have them, you know, just all released at once so I could watch them as I want, especially with this episode, because it really builds the tension.
Right.
This really builds on the characters and, like, the situation, and it just it makes it so, like, now... kind of left in the lurch for a while. So
this seems to me like it would be a super bingeable show, because the episodes are so tightly related and you're kind of left with a cliffhanger at the end. But that said, man, the fact that they're spread out and that, you know, we legitimately have to wait a week, like, it really, I'm really chomping at the bit by the time a week is up. Like, I think I do like the delay, because it makes me enjoy it more.
Yeah, the article goes into real quick. He just says that it should have been released as four Star Wars TV movies, basically.
Oh, okay.
Because they're really structured that way, I guess. Yeah. What do you think, Doug?
No, I think I'm with Scott on this one. I used your first name. I didn't just call you Baker.
That's great.
Yeah.
See, yeah.
I'm doing that.
We're learning.
No, I'm.
We just doxed ourselves, like, all around, I think.
We did. You can edit this, right?
Sure.
Fix it in post.
I mean, I'm not gonna, but I could.
No, I agree. The waiting is building a certain tension, building a certain eagerness. I'm looking forward to the episode coming out. Whereas if they all released, I would totally just binge it and be done with it in one night.
I think even Netflix has, I mean, Netflix really, you know, they, what's the word, invented, you know, the binge format where they dump all the episodes on the same day. And they've been doing that for years now. But I think even they have done some studies now and they've realized that audiences and members say that they want to binge things. They want everything to come out on Friday and they want to spend the whole weekend watching it. But if you're looking at it from a business point of view, if you're looking at it from Netflix point of view, the audience engagement with a television show is significantly higher if you spread it out like this. So people say they want it one way, but people get engaged with the show more. They talk about the show more. The show has longer legs if it's spread out versus just all dumped on the same day. So on a show like this, I'm really liking it because the tension builds, and this is clearly a tension show. You know, if you're talking about a, yeah, I don't know, the kids' cartoon show, probably doesn't matter. But a show like this, I'm kind of digging it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Should we dive into the episode?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? All right, cool. So episode opens in Cyril's mom's apartment, and you see Cyril sitting on his bed, and he looks out the window to see the sunrise. And I thought it was interesting to note that Cyril and his mom live way down, essentially in the bottom floor or near the bottom floor of this high-rise apartment. And on Coruscant, if you live on the bottom floors of the apartment, because just the nature of the city, the sunlight doesn't get down there. That's where the crime is. So that the lower parts of buildings are usually kind of the slums, and it's indicated to the audience that that's where Cyril lives, because he looks out his window and he looks way up and you see a building and then you see the sun coming up and he's watching the sunrise. And then you realize that he's not even actually seeing the sunrise. What he's seeing is the sun reflecting off of another building. So it's really just showing the audience, like, dude, he's living way down at the bottom of this building. And clearly he's not happy with his life because now he's living with his mom. And you can kind of tell he's just kind of depressed because he's just lost his job. But he has a, you know, I don't know, a little 3D hologram projector that's kind of common in the Star Wars universe. And he holds it up in his hand and it has like just a picture of Cassian Andor's face, and it just kind of rotates. And so he's sitting there on his bed watching the sunrise and just obsessing over Cassian, the one that got away, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. Did you? No, you haven't gotten to the point where they're at the table yet.
No. So yeah. Do you want to talk about that? So the next thing that happens is it cuts to that. That was the very opening of the scene. It's just basically Cyril looking pensive while he tries to figure out what he's going to do with his life and how he's going to get back at Cassian. And then it cuts to the kitchen, and he's sitting at this table, and his mom comes in, and they are having breakfast. And what did they have for breakfast, Doug?
It's blue milk cereal.
They had both breakfast cereal and blue milk. So this is the second reference to blue food in Andor, right? Because we had the blue noodles originally, right?
Oh, I think that's a good point.
And so basically, Cyril's mom just lays into him, and she, you know, is like, "What are you gonna do? Do you have any prospects? What's, you know, what are you going to do with your life?" So up to this point, we don't know for sure that he's lost his job, but I mean, I think it's pretty clear if his mom is telling him, like, what the heck are you going to do with your life? And he doesn't have a good answer for her. So his mom says that she's going to call in a family favor from Uncle Harlow. And that's sort of where it's left. And Cyril is clearly uncomfortable that his mom is kind of riding him and, you know, not giving him a lot of credit. And he's clearly not happy about being stuck living with his mom again. And so, he was even more unhappy that she's going to have to call in a favor.
Just checking in with you too, because that I am not like the super nerdiest Star Wars fan out there. Is Harlow a name that we should know, or is this like a new introduction in the show?
I am not aware of anybody named Harlow in the universe. In fact, there was a big thread on Reddit about who Uncle Harlow is going to turn out to be. I suspect that Uncle Harlow is going to be some character in the Andor universe. You know, not someone in the larger Star Wars universe, but that remains to be seen. Jason?
The only thing I thought of is that Lieutenant Gorn said later on that there was an engineer coming tomorrow, the next day. And so I don't know if that is connected at all.
Okay.
But I did want to mention just like this dynamic in this family is such a crazy vibe that I'm getting from her, from his mom. Like she's something else. I mean, she's a great actress. I looked her up a little bit. The only thing that she's done is her name's Catherine Hunter. She did The Witches from the recent Tragedy of Macbeth, I guess. So she played like all of the witches. She's good at playing like kind of creepy. But this is a weird vibe I'm getting from this whole family.
Yeah, she's a character for sure.
I mean, it's like it's kind of a cliche situation, right? The son gets laid off and is tough on his luck and has to move back in with the mom, and the mom kind of berating him. It's not an original situation, but just the way it's it's acted out, implemented. Is different enough, and that's kind of where I join, a lot of these plot points that maybe Doug had complained about the originality of the writing, but I don't think it's so much about that.
Yeah, so there's a little bit more with this, with Cyril and his mom later, so we'll come back to that. How about that? But yes, you're right, there is definitely a weird dynamic there. So
Not at all wooden at all. Like, definitely dynamic. We'll talk more later.
Okay.
You're just not going
to
like...
I was trying to goad you a little bit.
So the next scene, Cassian wakes up in a hammock in Vel's camp, and he kind of panics that his belongings weren't directly with him, but turns out they were. So you can tell, it's setting the scene, that he's worried that the other squad members may either steal his stuff or go through his stuff. So Cassian wakes up and he sees Skeen, one of the other squad members, is shirtless, and he has gone through Cassian's, the rest of Cassian's stuff, his backpack or whatever. And when Cassian, or I should say Clem, calls him on it, he says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, slow down. I'm just doing this because Vel told me to." And Cassian gets a little upset, like, what the heck are you doing going through my stuff? And then he walks over and they have a conversation, and again, Skeen, sorry, I had to look up his name, is shirtless, and you see that he has a tattoo on his chest, and he makes mention to Cassian, "Hey, I saw you notice my tattoo. You must have been there too," essentially is what he says. And if you look closer at the tattoo, it's actually a barcode, and he makes mention that the tattoo is from Krayt, Krayt. And I've never heard that name before, but it's implied that there was that they shared some sort of bad war experience, both because Cassian mentions that he was there as well, or maybe not there, but in the same battle. So there was some sort of like Vietnam style experience where they were both in this battle and it has scarred them enough that they're having a shared experience about this. So one of the things that was mentioned online was that the tattoo that Skeen has on his chest is could be considered analogous to how the Nazis tattooed the Jews during World War II, especially because Skeen's tattoo was a barcode.
Yeah.
So there's some sort of concentration camp style thing going on.
Yeah, I didn't. You were talking about like a Vietnam style battle. I was thinking more like that, just that concentration camp. Like
right.
They were prisoners of probably the Empire, I'm guessing. But
that would make sense, sure, yeah. And ultimately the scene ends with a quote, and the quote that what Skeen says is, he said, "The axe forgets, but the tree remembers." And I'm like, oh, that's kind of a cool quote. Like, it doesn't really fit like right in this particular place. So like, I made note of it, but I was like, oh, that seemed a little strange. Well, it certainly comes back later, and we'll get to that later, but it's worth noting now that the quote was, "The axe forgets, but the tree remembers." And actually the title of the episode is "The Axe Forgets." So what'd you guys think of that interaction between shirtless Skeen and Clem? Hello?
Dead air. The quote that stuck out from me was, it's like, now it's our turn to do the chopping. It's, it seems like they're trying to set up a lot of the motivations for these characters, trying to portray Scheme specifically here in this scene, about at least give some background for him and some context for his involvement, and also some tension between him and Cassian, and you feel it for sure.
So,
go ahead.
I mentioned I wanted to talk a little bit less focus on the writing. Although I will just say I like how this scene played out. I like how Cassian was being so careful to answer without giving any sort of revealing information about himself. Or, both of them. It was like a little chess match
Yeah,
of.
for sure.
But apart from the writing, the location, the set design of this, like, I'm kind of digging this setting, this atmosphere. I also want to point out one of the things that happens in this scene is you see the two of them have their little interaction, and he's shirtless the whole time. As everyone else is getting up, they're all bundling up, they're wrapping up, they got the fire going. You can tell from everyone else's reaction it's cold. But then Cassian and Skeen are having this almost like they're posturing, like trying to act tough, like the cold's not bothering me type of vibe going on.
It did seem strange to me that he had his shirt off, because I mean, the only reason, story-wise, that his shirt needed to be off is 'cause so he could show off this tattoo. Like you said, it's early in the morning. It wasn't, it was midday and the sun was up. It was kind of strange that his shirt was off, but whatever. I did really like the writing in this because it was very much, they were guiding the audience through their shared history. Like, it's not like Cassian walked over and he said, "Oh, hey, I saw your tattoo. Were you in such and such? I was there too. What year were you that?" Like, where they just like spoon feed the backstory to the audience. Like, it's very nuanced in how that story is told, and the reluctance, I think, from Cassian to divulge more than he has to. So the writing on that particular scene, I thought was good.
I agree. Yeah.
So,
Well, in this, he also mentions that Cinta is sharing a blanket, and they kind of aim the camera at Vel. So I'm getting a hint on that.
okay, so that was one of the questions that I had was, yeah, so Cassian is maybe sort of kind of interested in the healer girl who's named Cina. It was Cina, I think. But yeah, Skeen warns her she's sharing a blanket with someone else, so basically back off. But it's not clear who. But yeah, Reddit was all over it, like, oh, clearly it was Vel. It has to be Vel. And I was like, okay, maybe I just wasn't paying that close of attention. But that seemed to be the consensus.
Yeah, that's definitely the vibe I picked up on throughout the episode.
Okay. The next scene cuts to Mon Mothma's apartment, and she is basically having breakfast with her husband. They have a little bit of back and forth, and then a girl named Leida, Leida, walks in, and you infer that this is their daughter. She is full of teen angst. Mon Mothma asks her about, driving her somewhere. I can only assume to school. And Leda just is really having nothing to do with it. They kind of get in this little fight, like, I don't want you to drive me. Dad said he'd drive me, blah, blah, blah. And then it was a super quick scene, and then it cut, and then it was over. And I couldn't really figure out the point of that scene. And this is one of the things I was going to ask you, because I usually take notes on all the scenes. And it seemed to me that there were a lot of episodes, or not a lot of episodes, a lot of scenes in this that are like 30 seconds long, like that one. Like, it would cut to that, or later it cuts to the garrison, or later it cuts to this, and like they don't have these long drawn out scenes, like just these quick flashes, and then it'll cuts back. So immediately after that Mon Mothma scene, it cuts right back to Vel's camp, and which is essentially probably 10 minutes later in the day after the Skeen and Cassian conversation. Nemec is now trying to offer him some food. And I just thought it was kind of weird. Am I the only one that noticed that there are like these interstitial scenes that are super quick?
Yeah, and that actually kind of flows with the tension, it seems like, in whatever whatever moment we're in, it seems like you're getting that tension of the interaction between Scheme and Cassian, and you get a quick cut between the tension in that breakfast, in that with Mom Mothma, some real passive aggressive energy happening there. So I've noticed this in the previous episode too. Even though there's not like any action, heavy action moments, you're seeing some tension building as these quicker cuts are happening. At least that's kind of how I've noticed.
I think just to go a little bit deeper with that too, you'll notice that like throughout the episode, there's rarely any moments where you feel a relief or a satisfaction or like, oh, okay, that concept or conversation or whatever paid off. I feel good. Everything almost ends on a sort of cliffhanger, mini cliffhanger.
Yeah.
It's really actually kind of cool how the tension builds throughout the whole episode. It's definitely giving me episode 2 type vibes.
So it cuts back to Vel's camp. Nemec is there. Nemec is the young kid we thought looked like Mouse from Matrix and the one that built the model. He offers Cassian some dray milk, which the drays are essentially the goats or the sheep or whatever that they have in the camp.
Oh, I thought it was gray. I thought they said gray milk. Literally they have blue milk and they have gray milk.
I did note that the milk was not blue. It was like tan or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, the implication there is they don't have a lot of food. They're kind of barely getting by out here. But he also shows him a navigation. He has like a handheld kind of piece of electronics. And I think Cassian makes mention that, oh, this is really old tech or something like that. And Nemec says, it's one of the best navigational tools ever built. Can't be jammed or intercepted. Something breaks and you can fix it yourself. So they're using some old tech here. I think that the implication is going to be that, you know, the Empire would be looking for newer tech or would have jammers out for newer tech. So they're gonna go old school as part of this heist that they're pulling. So after that, it cuts to a strange scene with Vel and Terramin and Andor, and they're talking about the payload inside of the garrison and how they're going to get it up onto the runway and escape with it. And they ask Cassian, how much do you think this weighs? And Cassian looks at him like they're crazy. He's like, well, what do you mean? Is this a test? Like, you don't know how much, whatever we're heisting, you don't know how much it weighs.
Yeah, this is a great scene to lay the, just to give you an indication, the whole payoff of this whole situation that Luthen put into motion. It's just such a good scene in so far as how they react to the information, how Cassian says, wait, what? You don't know how to do this? You don't know how to fly this ship? And
I mean, they're like,
you just tell us. And they're just like trying to hide their knowledge or lack thereof. And yeah, it's just a great scene. Yeah.
They're one day out from this heist and they haven't figured out the basics. Like, how much does the thing we're going to weigh or how we're going to steal, how much does it weigh and how are we going to get it into the ship?
Yeah, you get the indication that they'd kind of be fudged if Cassian wasn't
there.
Yeah,
they would be screwed if Cassian wasn't there. So Cassian goes on to explain, you know, how much he thinks or how they can get it loaded, and he knows about some secret lever that unlocks whatever. So, I mean, he sort of saves the day. Cassian at one point says, what were you going to do if I wasn't here? And I think Vel says, oh, we would have figured something out. So after that exchange, Cassian demands to fly the escape ship. He says, we can say that it was your idea. I don't care. But if it's my ass on the line, I'm pulling this thing out of here or out of there. So he's, you know, pretty frustrated at this point that they don't have their stuff a little more together, and basically demands to fly, which I thought was the plan originally, because wasn't that kind of the point, was that he was a pilot? But anyway, he basically demands that he...
That's a good point. I thought the same thing.
So, they basically...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
The only other thing that I thought was worth... mentioning in this was that Terramin gives him his backstory as a soldier. He's talking about his history And at one point, I don't even remember what happened. He touched or he leaned into Cassian, and Cassian gets super defensive. And he says, "Don't touch me. You want something, you tell me." And I thought it was really kind of weird. Like, he was super defensive about this guy touching. Like, it wasn't an aggressive touch. I think, like, he was checking out his uniform or moving him out of the way or something. But Cassian was very unhappy that he touched him. And I wasn't super clear why he was so angry.
I think it's just to show that they kind of don't trust each other. There's just real like discordance with this group. They're kind of hinting at that there's like they're looking out for a traitor. Like there's gonna be somebody that is gonna turn. And if you're like familiar with cliches in heist movies and stuff, there's usually some sort of traitor. So, along those lines, I'm kind of hoping there that at least we don't see kind of like I know that we've seen some sort of like stock standard elements of plot, but I really kind of hope they subvert our expectations with all this build up going into the heist. It's just sort of like, aha, I have double.
So are you saying that you don't think, or you're hoping that Skeen isn't going to be the traitor? Because that's totally what they're setting up at the
You think
moment.
Skeen? Really? I was kind of thinking like Vel, on
Maybe
honestly.
Vel. I could see Vel. I do want to back up just a half step, though.
Hang on, but super quick before we change subjects, can I get my vote in for who I think the traitor is going to be?
Oh
Yeah.
yeah, of course.
It's going to be Mon Mothma's driver.
You think that they're going to be in on the heist?
I'm not even joking, because there's a scene later where their drive Mon Mothma and her husband are driving, and Mon Mothma or her husband says that he's talking about the driver, and he's like, "What's his name again?" And Mon Mothma has to like lean in and say, "Oh, it's Dave," or whatever. So she like they make a point about like what's the driver's name, and it's super weird. And I made note like,
See,
So anyway.
I got well. So they hinted at that in this previous episode, right? Like, oh, you got a new driver, right? Wink,
Yes.
wink, nudge, nudge. And I honestly kind of get the feeling that he's kind of a good dude. He's like, oh, I can't afford anything in here. Seem to be like looking out for things. So I kind of got the opposite, where he's more of a plant from maybe the rebel that's looking for Mon Mothma, maybe. But I do agree that he's an important character,
We'll see.
more so than they've let on. Yeah.
That's my guess. I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry, go ahead, Doug.
Okay, just to final thought on Nuge's point, of course he's an important character. He has lines, like literally just from a logistics perspective. Do you know how much more they have to pay an actor when they
Okay, but
actually
let me
speak
comment on that.
a
Let me comment on that, because in the interview, in the WTF podcast interview he did, he said that there's 190 some speaking lines in the series, which is
You
crazy.
mean
And we've
characters?
seen characters that speak,
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
Because you
You
have to
said
pay
lines.
them.
Yeah. Okay.
So that is really unusual. It just seems crazy. And we've seen a bunch of characters so far that have had lines, and we've just never seen them again. So that isn't really a tell, I think, in this. It would usually, right? It would
But
definitely
not in
usually,
this.
but with
Okay.
this show, it seems to be going kind of crazy.
Fair enough. I'd love to be surprised. But backing up to where I was going to point out, when Cassian demands to pilot the ship, and he tells Vel, he's like, "You can tell them it was your idea." What does she do? She capitulates. She goes along with it. So once again, one just kind of underscoring that she's sort of weak as a leader. Like, she lets her people tell her, this is what's going to happen, rather than the other way around. But then also, it makes you think, like, because Keen was saying, "Oh, don't worry, it was Vel's idea. She told me to do it." Well, did she? Or did he tell her, "I'm going to do this. You can tell everyone it was your idea," just like Cassian did?
Well, she has her moment. Like, Vel has her moments where she yells at him and gets everybody in line, and then she has other moments, like you said, where she capitulates. So, she's riding the fence, I think.
I'm not sold on her being a strong leader. I think
Potentially a traitor, maybe.
maybe.
her weak leadership is going to result in the group being in danger at some point.
I think that's a good observation.
The next scene of note is the squad is all together and they are running a marching drill. They're basically doing a dry run on this heist that they're going to do. There's four of them in line, and Cassian actually suggests switching sides because he notes that Skeen is left-handed and that you want your weapon on the outside of whatever group you're in because it's easier to fight. Vel kind of calls him on it, like, why would you want, why switch? And he explains, oh, well, he's left-handed, and then she kind of challenges him, well, okay, well, what's Tamarin? Oh, well, he's right-handed and shit. So she asks him, like, the four different people, and he knows what handedness each person is, sort of like showing off that he's observant. So Vel agrees, like, oh, okay, well, I guess that's good observation. And so they decide to switch, and right about then, because they're in that same valley they were in before, and the TIE fighter strafes by again, and they all yell, they're like, hide the guns. And so they all run and they basically hide the guns underneath this blanket or whatever, so that the TIE fighter that's flying by doesn't realize that they're armed, that they think that they're just farmers.
Yeah, that was another cool scene with the TIE fighters,
And it was, yeah, it was a super low pass by the TIE fighter. I mean, the TIE fighter was like 15 feet off the ground, maybe. So it was less about actually spying on them and more about just kind of harassing them.
Exactly. That's exactly what I took from it. They were not concerned about them. They were just like showing force or showing off. And it's kind of with the theme of the episode, like kind of the axe forgets, like the oppressor doesn't give a stuff about the oppressed. They just kind of like barely think about them.
This is also, I loved, absolutely loved the sound in this scene.
Oh, yeah.
How everything goes quiet, and then you hear the, I don't even know how to describe it,
The
a
screech,
whine
yeah, right.
screech of the TIE fighter, and it's just such a discordant, like, unnerving sound.
It's also kind of
And
long and drawn out too, because that like the TIE fighter like flies away for a while. It's not like a one and done. Like they kind of like hold for a beat on the TIE fighter as it flies away, just I think to build the tension a tiny bit more. But
well,
yes.
there's the initial pass where you just kind of get a little taste of it, and then it ducks down behind the trees, but it doesn't fully go away, and then it
Yeah.
kind of gets louder, and it makes the really close pass. It was just really
Yeah.
well put together.
Are you saying you geeked out a little bit, Doug? Maybe?
I enjoyed it. I will say that.
Right.
Yeah, I
Fair
enjoyed
enough.
that scene.
Right. Moving on.
There's another super quick scene where Cassian yells at Skeen for picking up his bag and attempting to move it. Like it's just in the way, and he just picks up his bag and moves it. And Cassian yells at him again, like, don't touch my stuff. And I couldn't really figure out why. I mean, clearly, like he wants to keep the Kyber crystal. He doesn't want them to know about that. But at this point, he has it around his neck, so he knows it's not in his
Yeah,
bag.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was trying to figure out, like, why are you making such a big scene out of this bag? You're just putting a target on your back. But
No, but you just light bulb, you just connected the dots. He does have it on him, which is why he got so upset when that other guy was touching him, because he didn't want him touching the crystal and finding out that it was there.
sure, and they do find it later, and we'll get to that, and that's a very, I think, critical scene. So
Yeah, that's a good point, Doug, actually.
the next scene of note is back in the Imperial Security Bureau, and Muro is still investigating those missing components. She's trying to figure out that there's some sort of, she's still convinced that there's some sort of larger plot to steal components from the Empire and start some sort of rebellion. I think she's starting to pick up on that. But if they look at all the components that are missing, they're all just totally random, and there's no rhyme or reason that connects them. And so she starts to, or I think the other guy starts to say, it's just too random. And actually, he goes on to elaborate. He's like, well, it's actually too random to be random. Like, so if, and Miro responds that if I was going to steal from the Empire, this is how I would do it, because it's so well done that it slips through the cracks. So
Yeah.
there's not a whole lot in this scene, but she has not given up her pursuit of something going on after the Starpath unit being missing. And then the scene ends with, oh, she make mention at the beginning of the scene, oh, are you still up? Because it's really late at night. And then the scene ends at the very end, and she takes a pill case out of her pocket and takes some pills. And the only thing that I could put together was that, you know, there's some sort of stay awake pills, because she's going to pull an all-nighter while she investigates more of these missing components. It was just kind of a weird scene, the way she popped the pills like that. Did you guys take anything else away from that?
It's obviously a reference to substance abuse of some sort, which is really interesting to see in a Star Wars, you know, property. So I just like was kind of flabbergasted that we've seen, like, we're seeing someone obviously abusing drugs in Star Wars.
There was a reference on
it. I don't know if I've ever seen that before.
There was a...
Yes.
Well, I think so. I mean, they sell death sticks in, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Oh, okay.
You don't want to sell me death sticks, Jedi hand wave.
The thing that the correlation that someone drew online was that the Nazis used to, I mean, it's well documented that they took meth, right? They were hopping their soldiers up because it makes them better fighters and they don't fall asleep. So someone made that connection, was that perhaps they're doing something similar.
Wow,
in the Empire.
That's an interesting connection. I mean, it connect that Matt, that tracks. Yeah.
So we don't know yet. Maybe it'll come up again. Maybe it won't. But it was just something that I noticed. So.
Mm-hmm. So I did catch a little bit of a Easter egg in their little conversation as she's trying to say, like, you know, there's just so much random stuff going on. He lists like a couple of different locations.
Yes, he right.
One of which was Kessel, mm-hmm. as in like the Kessel Run. And then Jakku was mm-hmm. the other name that I recognized. I don't remember.
Jakku is from Rogue One. I mean, that's where most of Rogue One takes place, right?
No, that's where Rey is from. Jakku.
Oh, you're right. You're right. You're right.
Is it Rey? Okay, I got that confused then, because I was also thinking Rogue One, but...
He mentioned several different places where things were taken, and they were, most of them were actual references to the larger Star Wars universe. Like you said, he mentions Kessel, and he mentions Jakku, and he mentions a couple other places, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess we got to tie this back. It was kind of nice playing in our own little universe for a while. The next scene, we're back at Vel's camp, and now it's night, and they are standing around a campfire, and the camera cuts into the fire, and you see that they are burning Nemec's model of the heist. So we are very close to them pulling off the heist, so they are basically destroying any evidence. They don't want to leave anything behind. And so it's just the squad standing around the fire watching this model burn. And this is actually the first time I think that I took notice of this. They say to the rebellion. So this is the first time I think they actually say rebellion anywhere in this series. So this is like a clearly we're ramping up to the larger rebellion.
Yeah. No going back now.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I think there in this scene, or maybe the scene before that, I just wanted to know something that I don't think anybody's seen, but like Cinta was teaching Cassian some languages or whatever. And she like helps him with his bandage at one moment. And then she smiles for a bit. And I think this might be the only time Cinta actually smiles I've seen at all. And then Vel kind of scolds
Gets Cassian. Jealous.
Yeah. She says, you can dress yourself. So, I guess I'm really picking up on the love triangle.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I usually don't even pay attention to that stuff. It's probably why I missed it.
Since we're still here, I just have another random note to throw in about this whole scene and setting. Those are some of the most metal looking goats ever.
Yeah, with the four horns and they're bright, or they're dark black.
Totally, dude. They look like an album cover.
They do. It does. Right. Good point. So after they chant to the rebellion, the scene cuts. We're back in Cyril's mom's apartment. This is another one of those like 30-second cuts that I don't totally understand, but basically Cyril's mom says Uncle Harlow said he wants to help, but he needs to think about how. So originally she was worried that Uncle Harlow may not even be interested in helping, but she has talked to him and he is interested in helping, but he doesn't know how yet. So he's going to come up with a plan. The implication being here that Harlow is somehow going to offer Cyril a job. So I think the implication here is that perhaps he works in the government or he works for somebody in the Empire and can pull some strings to get him a job, but it's not really clear. And Cyril is even more frustrated that his mom is meddling in his life and trying to get him a job. And there's not a whole lot to that scene. So Uncle Harlow is on it.
Yeah. I like that we're following Karn continually to follow Karn for really no apparent reason.
But yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with this is it's got to be leading somewhere, but it's not clear where.
Yeah, I mean, it'll go somewhere for sure.
The next thing we see is Vel's group, the squad, is walking. They have basically broken camp, and they have packs, and they're carrying gear, and they're walking. And they're just basically going over the details of the heist. Who's going to be where, and how is this going to execute, and where are the weak points on this? And they're just, you know, making conversation while they're marching or walking. Cassian asks Vel about Lieutenant Gorn, because Lieutenant Gorn is kind of like a wild card in this, especially to Cassian, because he doesn't know who this is. He's like, why is this Empire guy helping us? Like, that's a huge risk to him and a huge risk to us. And so Vel tells Cassian that she's talking about Gorn's backstory, and she says that he fell in love with a local woman and lost a promotion, and then he lost the woman, and then he lost his taste for the Empire. So we don't know what happened exactly to Gorn, but clearly he must have got past that for a promotion or something in the Empire, and then simultaneously lost his girlfriend about something, and then now he's angry at the Empire. It was kind of a weird scene, but they're just trying to give him a little backstory about why he would be helping.
Yeah, and it's a great, throwaway. But you also saw, like, there was an earlier scene where he's talking to a private on, like, a watchtower or something, and he's talking about the landscape being torn down, and the private tells him, or asks him, like, how many local for the eye, you know, and for the celebration? Mm-hmm. He says, like, around 100. And then the private says, oh, just enough so you can smell them. So you get the hint that, like, the culture around there really doesn't like the locals. Hmm. And Gorn, he's playing along, but knowing all the pieces, putting all the pieces together, you know, he's really kind of fed up.
Well, the next scene is a Gorn-heavy scene. So the next scene, they are inside of the garrison that is going to be the set piece for the heist, and there are a bunch of Empire guys basically there, you know, cleaning up and guarding it and doing whatnot. And so the eye, which is that celestial event that they're going to use as a escape route, is going to be the next night, so in 24 hours. So the heist is going to be in 24 hours. And Gorn is in charge of scheduling the roster for the night of the eye. And so the Empire guards are basically jockeying for position, because this is like a once in a lifetime, not once in a lifetime. It's a rare thing that they would get to go see this. And so they're trying to get as many people to be able to go see this. And the line from, you know, the random Empire guy was, Aldani, sir, it's not many people's first choice assignment. The thing you hear when you're posted to Aldani is that perhaps you'll be lucky enough to be there for the eye. So there's a lot of the morale on this outpost is pretty low, and that the high point for a lot of these officers is that, hey, at least they get to see the eye. So it's setting the scene that Gorn is in charge of the roster, and he's going to try and get as many guards as he can out of this garrison so they can pull off this heist. And the last thing you see is that it cuts to these big, like, triangle shaped piles of tubes that look like they contain gold or something, and I think you can only infer that that's the payroll that they're gonna heist.
That's the money shot.
And I don't think we talked about it on the podcast last time, but we talked about, like, did they just not have online banking in the Star Wars universe? Like, who drives around with like $8 billion in gold? Like, it seems really strange that this payroll is in actual, you know, physical any type of currency that could be stolen, because clearly, I mean, it's going to be part of this heist. But I mean, and the these piles of gold, I noted they were about 7 feet high because they were in front of a guard, and if you assume the guard is 6 feet tall, they were taller than him. I mean, this is a lot of contraband that they're going to be stealing, and I can only imagine it's going to be heavy if it's metal. But
what, how much does it weigh?
But that's only Cassian knows.
Yes.
So the next thing we see, where we cut back to Vel's group, and Skeen actually sneaks up behind Cassian and sticks a knife to his throat and actually takes the Sky Kyber Stone necklace from Cassian and holds it up and shows everybody. And he basically is trying to out Cassian because they don't trust Cassian, or at least Skeen doesn't trust Cassian. And he has a really good line. He says, he comes here with nothing but the clothes on his back and a stone worth 30,000 credits, ? So he's definitely concerned about the impetus for Cassian showing up, especially if he's got, you know, this large amount of money. And then he follows it up with what I thought was a great line. Who brings a treasure to a robbery? So
yeah, that was a great line. I'm curious what Nuge thinks of this scene.
It's completely understandable that they're skeptical of this guy who's just brought in at the last minute. Heists always have a traitor, so, I mean, you know, it's got to be Cassian because he's the new one. And the fact that he has this 30K valuable crystal, or 50, you know, depending on who you talk to, does throw things off a lot, but I think it's a necessary scene, especially later in the scene. So
the squad is suspicious of Cassian because he has this really expensive necklace, and so Cassian has to come clean. So he tells them, he's like, "Hey, I'm being paid." He says, "I'm only really here for the money." And so they all kind of, they're like, wait a second, you're getting paid? Like, whoa, this changes everything. Like, what's going on? Because, you know, now maybe you're not as invested as the rest of us are, because they are, you know, living, breathing the rebellion, and he's just there for a paycheck. And so Vel has to get involved, and she says, hey, look, here's the deal. We were told that we had to take Cassian, or we had to call the whole thing off. So we had two choices, and I chose to take Cassian because we really need the money, essentially.
This to me was an example yet again of her weak leadership.
Yeah.
And I know you suggested earlier that there was a scene coming up where, you know, she exerted control over the group and they listened to her and backed down. And no, that's not the case.
No, it's not. Yeah, you're right. It's not this thing.
Because
she's
like, she's telling Skeen back down. He's like, no, I'm all out of questions. I need answers. Yeah. Like, I'm not backing down. Tell me what I want to know. And it even escalates further because Cassian goes to pull a gun on him, and then one of the other guys is like, hey, don't reach for that. And then this whole Mexican standoff, and what is it that breaks it up? It's not her telling everybody to calm down. It's the sound of the TIE fighter.
Okay.
Yeah, and she says we can talk about later, safe, or another time, and they're getting ready to go, and there's like a pause. Cassian kind of takes charge in that moment and says, okay, I need to lay it out and I need to do it right now. And he, you know, he says what they're all kind of suspecting is he's not really a true believer. So it's a really, I think it's a really important scene to not only bring this group together, but to kind of give an indication of where a lot of people are coming from, especially with their relationship to Cassian and each other. So yeah, this is like kind of the climactic scene.
I think there's also an interesting line near the end of the scene from Cassian, you know, as he's sort of calling out Skeen, you know, saying like, hey, even if I had told you from the beginning, it just would have been something else. You know, the day before is always hard. You know, your mind is going to wander. But the way that he says that, the day before is always hard, has this subtle implication of, I've been through this. I know these feelings. Yeah. I've gone through this before. I'm experienced, therefore you should trust me.
Do you get the impression that Cassian's like the only one that's ever been involved in a heist?
Yeah.
Like all these other people are green and he's this total outsider, but yeah, he's the one that's not nervous. He's the one that's, yeah, right.
He really takes charge here and yeah, kind of asserts to be the leader in some ways.
I really liked this scene. I think the writing was good. I mean, it moves the story forward without spoon feeding it to the audience. And there were, you know, those lines about who brings a treasure to a robbery. I mean, those are all completely valid concerns. And I think it's a good form of storytelling, and it's without making it too obvious. So the next scene is the scene that I alluded to earlier of Mon Mothma is riding in the back of her car with her husband. And the driver is there. This is another one of those 30-second scenes. Mon Mothma's husband asks her, he says, "Oh, I hear you have a new foundation. How did I not know about that?" And she says, "Well, I didn't think you'd be interested. It's charitable." And then, so, you know, there's this just more back and forth between Mon Mothma and her husband. They kind of have a relationship of convenience, not necessarily of love. But again, there is that mention of the driver's name. It felt very... not forced. It didn't feel forced. It felt out of place. Like that was the one thing in the Scooby-Doo episode. You're like, oh, okay, this is going to come back later. Or
well, they were fighting about it earlier, right? They're being really passive aggressive. Oh, you got a new driver. Oh, don't you know his name and stuff?
Oh, were they?
Yeah, so there was a little play with that.
Okay. Earlier.
So that anyways, kind of like gives them excuse to say his name and stuff.
They do name drop him, and I don't remember what his name was, so I assume it'll come back later just because it was sort of an oddball scene.
Chloris. I just looked it up. Chloris.
Okay.
Chloris?
Yeah, now we know. Now we all feel better about that?
I do. I'll be able to sleep tonight.
Okay.
We got 1.5 more scenes. The penultimate scene is that the squad arrives at the top of this mountain range, essentially, and they are right down overlooking the garrison. They signal Gorn with a torch. So Gorn is looking up on this mountain range with some night vision goggles, and he sees whoever it is, you know, waving around this torch, just indicating to him that they have arrived and that they are in place.
That is so... Okay. I'll let you finish the summary, but I do want to come back and point out just how stupid of a signaling method that is. That really bugged me with the scene.
No, I'm with you. Like, you don't even need night vision goggles for that. That was super easy to see. But I think the implication is that this garrison is so understaffed and that it's in the middle of nowhere that no one's going to see this. Plus, you know, maybe Gorn controls the job duty so he can make sure that, you know, only he is out there, but I don't know. But the point is that Gorn is now aware that they are in place. So there's a quick exchange between Skeen and Cassian, where he talks about why Skeen is involved and why he hates the Empire. And Skeen tells Cassian that the Empire took his brother's farm, took his brother's land, flooded it, and ultimately, Skeen's brother took his own life. So Skeen has basically always hated the Empire. And the only other thing that's worth noting is Cassian asks him what kind of farmer he was. And he says pepper trees. And he says they've basically been in the family for 100 years. Did you guys pick up on that?
Yeah, he says centuries of them. Is that what you mean by hundreds of years? Okay.
So the only reason I think that's interesting is because it circles back to the axe forgets, but the tree remembers. So this is like a direct tie-in with the Empire like completely screwed over my brother and my family. They caused him to kill himself, and I'm really ticked. So like the Empire, there's no way they remember his brother or whatever, but he was essentially saying, I remember and I'm going to take revenge because that's, you know, I'm not going to put up with it.
Yeah, I mean, this is also a really important scene. I mean, this is... Okay, this might be the first, like, suicide reference in Star Wars also.
Weird.
But, yeah, like, the fact that he says this, the axe forgets, the tree remembers, was a little odd to begin with, but then now that you know his backstory, it makes sense.
The fact that his brother raised trees, it's much more apropos.
Yeah, it's like, oh... Damn. It's a really
it's worth noting that the Empire could have come in and took his farm and just killed his brother, but it was almost worse than that. They took his land, flooded it, and his brother was so depressed that he took his own life. So like that's even worse, I think, in my book, right? You know, like,
yeah, he says, I've always hated the Empire,
yeah,
but now I don't know what to call it, how I, like, that's just rough.
That was a cool line.
Yeah.
So the last or line in this scene is that Vel basically tells Cassian that Terramin is now in charge, completely in charge, and she makes sure that Cassian and everyone else know this, that Terramin is the de facto leader, and when Cassian asks her why or where she's going to be, she says, she says, I won't tell you, but you'll see tomorrow night. So she's being a little cagey that she's leaving. She's got some sort of side mission as part of this heist, and that Terramin is in charge.
Yeah, sorry, I just had, like, I was like, what? Okay, what? Haven't they, like, talked about this before? Like, this is the plan? Or Val is leaving with Cinta unannounced? Yeah. Like, is this new? I don't know. It's just, what is going on here?
Yeah, it's kind of surprising that in an 8-man crew with this heist that has to go absolutely perfect because the odds are stacked against them, that there is still some sort of, like, secret aspect to this heist.
Well, yeah, I had to come up with some reason in my brain for them to, like, not freak out that this is a thing, but it seemed like it was new information, but maybe not. Maybe this was the plan all along. It's just portrayed in a weird way. This was, like, one thing that stuck out to me, weird and bad writing, I guess.
Doug, what did you think about this semi-final scene?
Yeah, no, it did bug me a little that, you know, they've been drilling the plan nonstop over the last couple of days, and this
months.
Well, no, I mean with Cassian.
Well, sure, okay, might have changed.
And to be fair, nobody else in the group reacted or was surprised by that.
Okay, sure. So maybe they all knew.
Yeah, what's her face? Vel's girlfriend just kind of picked up her Eastern European looking machine gun and was like, all right, let's head out.
Well, it seemed like she was in on it for sure. Like, they were going to be like, all right, see you guys. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe this is part of them not trusting Cassian, that they're like, that Vel is going to be their out if Cassian betrays them. I don't know. We'll see.
I think what it is more of a, from Cassian's perspective, like, how much trust has he established? Because now his protector, so to speak, the one who vouched for him, she's gone.
Oh, good point.
So he's either established trust with the rest of the group, or they're going to kill him.
There's nobody to talk Skeen down if they get in a fight again, huh?
I think they've done the work to break that ice wall of trust. I think they've done so. It doesn't seem like it's that really to me. Like, I don't know. I guess it's very up for interpretation, but yeah, I don't know if it's like so like still hanging out there that they don't trust Cassian. I think they've done the work. They've said, okay, he's a mercenary. You know, he's not perfect. None of us are. They've done that. You know, they've gone through it.
Yeah, no, I think that was kind of the point of the majority of this episode, is working through some of those trust issues. But this is the kind of, she puts it right out there. She's like, he's in charge, like, totally. You know, I need to know you're good with that. And that's sort of the go or no go moment. And he's okay with it. And now that leads us right up to the, you know, the edge of the, the heist.
They got no choice.
Yeah.
So the final scene on this is another one of those 30-second scenes, and it cuts to Luthen, and he is in his fake store, that museum, whatever, and it's night, and it's dark, and he's in the back, and he's looking really haggard and tired and stressed out, and he has an old radio, so this is not new Star Wars tech. He has an old radio, and he's basically listening for any news about the heist as it happens. So again, the implication is like perhaps the rebels are using older technology that the Empire might not pick up on because he has this old radio.
He's nervous.
He's super nervous.
That's so, from an audience perspective, like, that's unnerving. The guy who's shown the most confidence throughout the whole series so far, he's nervous.
Yeah, so like, he's concerned because, and I think he actually says that he perhaps didn't vet Cassian enough, because if Cassian is captured, it will lead directly back to him. And then he, you know, some of the others, he would have plausible deniability about. They don't tie to him, but Cassian specifically ties directly to him, and then he will be having a bad day. So he actually asks his assistant, I guess is who that is. He's nervous and he's worried about her, and he asks her about her walkaway pack. Have you checked your walkaway pack? Because he's just basically prepping that this thing may go bad and we just may have to get the heck out of Dodge. So the only other thing I think that's of note, and this is what we talked about a little bit earlier, was inside of Luthen's shop, there are a couple of Easter eggs on the shelf behind him while he's looking stressed out. There is a square cube and a triangle-shaped pyramid that are a Jedi and a Sith holocron. So I think that's kind of a nod to the larger universe. The
what are those?
They're old technology from way back in the day, and they were used to record like memories or history, I believe.
Oh, okay.
They're not super important to the story. I think it's just a nod to the larger Star Wars world that these have come up in some of the animated series, not necessarily in the movies, but they are there on the shelf. And then actually, if you look to the right of those, there are three kind of dome-shaped shiny stones that are the three stones from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I forget what they're called. They start with an S, but I looked them up earlier, and it's 100% that's what those are. So whatever sort of curio shop Luthen is working in is very Easter egg heavy.
Those belong in the museum.
They do. That's true.
Wow, that's interesting. Huh.
So that's and after that, it's a star wipe, and the episode ends. And
oh no, you're not doing it justice.
The last
line is epic.
What was it? I don't even remember.
She says to him, "By this time tomorrow, it'll all be over." And he says,
"Oh, yeah.
Or it'll have just started."
Yeah.
And then they star wipe.
And yeah, and Luthen essentially wipes the sweat from his brow because he is going to have a long night, I think. So, yeah, that was the episode. A lot more character building, a lot more tension building. Clearly, I think we're going to see the heist in the next episode. You guys were convinced it was going to be in this one, but it's going to be the end of this sixth episode. What about a rating, Doug?
Well, I for sure felt like this one kind of picked it back up. It slipped a little in the last episode for me, but I'm right back to eagerly anticipating what happens next. I really enjoyed the pacing. I really enjoyed the, like I talked about in the beginning, some of the sound was really cool. Some of the set design was really cool. So I'm gonna give this one an 8.
Okay. Jason?
Yeah. Actually, I was going to give it the same score, but because I thought it dropped a little bit, not because of the structure or the writing or anything that was like lacking, but it just felt like a very much a part of a larger whole. Whereas, you know, like even the episode before, it felt like you're entering a whole new planet, a whole new set of characters. It felt like a real piece unto itself. This just feels like very much a middle part, and it does things really skillfully. It builds tension, like you said. It really gives us a face to the rebellion. It fleshes it out in a way that we haven't seen before, in a very personal way. More character development. I'm really anxious to know what's happened. I guess that's part of my criticism, is just I want to know what happens next. And the thesis of the episode, I mean, gives it another quality of just the axe forgets, the violence of the oppressor is felt and remembered deeply by those oppressed. The oppressor themselves never relates in the same way and often doesn't or considers what's happening. I mean, it's a strong theme for an episode. So 8.
Well, I think we're in agreement, because I give this a solid 8 too. There was a really good amount of storytelling and character development and plot advancement in this, and I think it was done really well. I did not feel like the last episode, like there were those kind of standout scenes that were like, why is this here? I mean, there were a couple. I think maybe the car ride with Mon Mothma and her husband was a little bit weird. And like I said, there was just several of those scenes that were just like 30 seconds long, and it was just like an interstitial to hop between two scenes. I kind of wish that maybe the scenes that, you know, we had less number of scenes and more longer scenes, so you could stick with a story element a little bit longer. That may just be a storytelling method that they've chosen to, you know, use for this show. I'm not going to fault them for that until we see how it pays off. Just some other TV shows that I've watched, like they don't have so many, quite so many little scenes. It seems a little schizophrenic. But other than that, I loved it. And it's just, yeah, just a bunch of tension for the next episode when we're going to see. I think the action is going to really kick up a notch next episode. So 8 out of 10 from me. The
8's all around.
8's wow. All around. Hmm. So yeah, we'll see what happens next week.
So just one closing thought. I have no idea of what the next episode's going to bring, but in regards to your critique about the number of quick scenes, consider this. Is it intentional from a pacing perspective to keep you off balance and make you feel a little uncomfortable and almost like you're constantly guessing and trying to catch up and figure out what's going on?
Interesting.
Just okay. A thought.
No, that's a good point. Like I said, I feel like, I mean, these guys clearly know what they're doing. I feel like it's a storytelling element that I just don't understand yet. And I that could very well be it, is it may be designed to keep you off balance or off guard. Like that was one of the things that I didn't realize until I read it online, was they were talking about The Shining and how basically the music in The Shining is essentially a fourth character, and the sound design in The Shining is a fourth character. None of the music in The Shining is quote unquote good. It's all very unnerving and weird, and it contributes to the tension. So yes. I wonder if, now that you say that, if that's not part of what they're doing here, is trying to keep you off your guard. So, okay, perhaps. All right, that makes it all the much better. So, well, I do know that I enjoy this show much more when we go over it with you guys and we talk about all the weird things that I didn't catch. So I appreciate you guys taking the time.
Jason, do you want to... Logic Gate out.